You are now listening to the Spirits Distilled podcast presented by WSET, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. For more information on taking a WSET qualification, please visit our Where to Study page on our website, wsetglobal.com. We hope you will enjoy the program, and if you do, please take a moment to subscribe and rate Spirits Distilled on whatever podcast platform you are coming to us from. Listeners to the Spirits Distilled podcast, presented by WSET, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. I'm Dave Rudman, and I'll be your host for this, episode number 5 of Spirits Distilled. As always, you can expect Spirits Distilled to bring you knowledge and diverse perspectives from WSET's experts, as well as from throughout the world of spirits. We've got a lot of information, we've got a lot of fun planned, let's get right into it. In our main feature for this episode, we'll be picking up right where we left off last episode with Adding Flavor Part 2, Electric Boogaloo. Back again is WSET's Liam Scandrett, Business Development Manager Spirits, whose guest in this episode is Tom Gibson, Director and Flavor Architect at Flavorman. Tom Gibson has been in the flavor industry for over 25 years. He is one of only a few hundred individuals worldwide to be certified by the Society of Flavor Chemists. As the director and flavor architect for Flavorman, Tom delivers flavor innovation to all aspects of the beverage development business. Folks, when it comes to adding flavor, you wanted the best, you got the best. Let's jump right in with Liam and Tom now.
Would you like to take a minute or two to introduce yourself and what you do at Flavorman and what the company do?
Sure. So my name's Tom Gibson. As you said before, I'm a flavorist here. What I do is develop flavors for, in this particular case, just for beverages. There's flavors that develop flavors for all different types of confections. Anything that you eat may have a flavor that's been developed and added. So at Flavorman, we develop beverages for the beverage industry, and it can be just about anything. So we say, if you can think it, we can make it. And that starts with our beverage development department, which takes ideas from our customers and turns them into marketable products. And so in this case, I'm kind of the guy in the background that is developing that flavor profile that's going into that finished beverage that customer's looking for. And that may be something that came from someone's grandmother's recipe that we're translating into a marketable product, which can be somewhat difficult. But, it's a very specific profile that evokes a memory. And so people are pretty passionate about these things. So it's a great job, but sometimes it can be difficult and somewhat frustrating to translate what people are saying and turn that into essential oils and aroma chemicals that evoke that same emotion. But that's what we do here at Flavorman. It's a great industry. It's a very fun job. And one, like you said, that not many people have heard of before. It's sure. Kind of a round to the food industry.
I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, listeners to this podcast are fairly used to hearing from brand ambassadors, distillers and blenders from spirits production, certainly, but they rarely hear from someone supplying those brands with particular flavors. It'd be interesting to learn more about the process for you. Like, where does it begin? Is every single flavor you create a bespoke solution for a particular customer, or do you have a palette, a flavor house essentially, and you can sell individual flavors?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, Liam, you probably have never heard of us because we're just locked in labs with chains. You know, we're never let go. We're very, very often we don't get out to see our customers. No, not true. So in our case, it's different for every company. In our case, it's custom manufacturing of flavors for our customers. So what we like to do pre-COVID is work hand in hand with our customers in-house, developing the beverage and working on that flavor profile, walking through, what that specific flavor profile is. And we like to break that down to specific compounds, right down to a simple ester. It could be aldehydes, acids, ketones, essential oils, whatever that is, and build around that into that specific flavor that they that they're looking for. In the case of other flavor houses, there are many stock flavors that they would maybe start from sampling, and then maybe there'd be further development after that. In our case, it's custom development for every flavor. Sometimes a painstaking process, but I think it actually gets to the point that the customer's looking for quicker, more accurately, and I think just makes a better product overall.
Sure. Are there any particular products that you've worked on that we would know over here in the UK that you can tell us about?
Well, that's part of the problem of why you don't hear of us, because we're always in the background and it's always that top secret information. And most of our customers don't want you to know what flavor house they use to develop it. So unfortunately, I can't speak to that.
You must have signed many non-disclosure agreements.
Oh, daily. Yes, many.
Okay, so I'd be interested into delving a bit deeper into the kind of raw materials and apparatus that you play with on a daily basis. I mean, what are the raw materials for a flavor architect? Are we talking about natural botanicals, neutral spirits?
Yeah, you hit it. It's really different for every flavor company. There's a lot of different people say a flavor is a flavor is a flavor. Well, that's not really the case, because some flavor companies work with, say, specifically organic compounds or specifically artificial flavors, which is really not that the case anymore. It's mostly, I'd say 90% of the market is natural flavors, and more so even specifically marketed to different companies, say like a Whole Foods. So for us, those materials are typically natural materials, and those can be the basis being those botanicals in different forms, which could be solid extracts, they could be essential oil, CO2 extracts from a variety of different sources. Say cinnamon, for example, we would have an oleoresin, an oil, we may have specific fractions from the cinnamon, and it could be from India, Sri Lanka, around the world. There could be different sources for just one oil to give specific profiles. Those are typically the building blocks of a flavor. And then to break it down even further, we're looking at those aroma chemicals that pinpoint specific profile. So if you're looking for a very peely mango, you might be starting with a mango extract or distillate, but that specific molecule, say, could be myrcene. And that myrcene could give that peely Alfonso mango profile that you're looking for. So it's kind of a play between all the different materials that are found in nature, and to make them more stable and marketable, we're looking at those specific materials and then concentrating them so that they can deliver a consistent and quality product in the end.
Said something interesting there at the start about 90% of flavors on the market being from natural sources. I think that's something that's a bit misunderstood maybe by people in the trade, and thinking that purchased flavorings in this way are synthetic. But your point of view is that actually they're natural. You know, they are natural representations.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. And I think there is a lot of confusion around that. That goes to transparency as well and what people are consuming. So as a flavor house, in I say the old days, many of those materials were maybe synthetically derived because they weren't available from a natural source. So a lot of the flavors were artificial or natural and artificial. As better technologies come about goes into actually the specific profile of a flavor, our market's steered towards natural. In the U.S., we have different declarations of natural. We have natural FT&F, natural WOMP, natural type, and they all mean specific things. So when we're talking about essential oils, those are naturally derived from, say, lemongrass, orange oil, whatever that might be. And if you break that down even more and you look at the specific components, say, limonene, leucine, gamma terpenine, alpha pinene, those are all natural, organic, naturally occurring materials that are in those known materials. Now, not always can you get that material in the quantity needed around the world for, say, orange flavors or mango flavors, whatever that might be, from specifically that material. And it could be naturally derived as a byproduct from other things. Say we're talking about hexyl compounds like hexanol, those green grassy compounds. Maybe they're not all coming from an apple that makes up green apple because there's not a lot available, but it might come as a byproduct of, it could be fermentation of grass or whatever that might be, but that, don't quote me on what that is. So they are natural, they're naturally derived. They just don't come from the source that you're quoting. So in our case, we would say that's a natural type because it doesn't come from the name.
So they're naturally occurring chemical compounds. They're just pieced together to replicate a particular flavor from various sources, potentially.
Got it. You got it. A really good example of that is vanilla. And in the key component is vanillin. So that vanillin can come from a barrel that's toasted. That can come from the vanilla bean. That can come from turmeric. It can come from clove. It can come from all these different sources. So natural vanillin, in the old days, would come from a vanilla bean, but given the market of vanilla beans, there's not a lot of natural vanillin X bean to be had, and if you can get it, it's going to cost a fortune. So consumers don't really want to pay for that. So there are a lot of natural sources where you can get this vanillin from, and so those are often more affordable and more readily available in nature. So it plays across the boards for other materials too, but vanillin's always a good example.
And probably the one that our listeners and in many ways spirits students are most familiar with, because as you say, it's closely associated with oak and you know,
absolutely.
It's probably the most easily understood chemical compound in spirits flavor.
Yes, yeah.
And that's, you know, that's really, I think, what we're interested in at the WSET in terms of the spirit side is the origins of flavor, you know, and trying to get across to students that, you know, this, and take vanillin as an example, this bourbon tastes of vanilla because it contains compounds of vanillin that have been extracted from the oak during maturation, is a really interesting and sometimes challenging one, because, you know, they smell it and they think, well, it's got vanilla in it, i.e. somebody's added vanilla to it post distillation. But really, it's, you know, coming from the oak, and that's one example.
Yeah, I think that there's something to say for that. There's a beauty to make a flavor that makes a finished product great, but there's also, I mean, the art to actually extracting the vanilla and those inorganic compounds that come along with it. It can't be matched by a flavor. I mean, it's been tried and tried again, and people ask for that. And we call it, you know, it's probably such a thing as a holy grail of maybe a speed aged product with a flavor. So, I mean, I can offer you a flavor that is vanilla with some other compounds, but it doesn't always hit specifically what's being pulled from that barrel in that amount of time from that specific char of wood from that specific variety of wood. It's not an easy thing to do. That's something that you know, the art can only, I you know, we can assist, but we can't take GNS and add an oak flavor or a vanilla flavor and make it into a fine whiskey or whatever you're looking for in that case. So,
and you know, To take that on a step further, do you think that will always be the case, or there will ever be technology that will allow, and I suppose it's a matter of subjectivity to some extent, you know, can the taster tell the difference and the experience of that taster would set that precedent? But do you think we'll ever get to a point where the technology is there where you literally couldn't tell the difference, even if you were a very experienced taster?
Yeah. Good question. I would say no, but I think I might be wrong long term. If you look at the history of flavors and where actual flavors have come from, you know, say just as far back as maybe the 60s, 70s, the profiles of flavors are much more advanced. A strawberry actually tastes like a strawberry because a lot of those materials have been discovered that weren't discovered then, and have been able to be manufactured or extracted or whatever that might be. So, you know, what people perceive as a grape flavor might be a hubbub of a grape, because that started off because there weren't a lot of compounds to make something mm-hmm. that's really, truly a Concord grape. And that's developed into something where I could make a grape flavor that would be really close to, you know, whatever that varietal might be. So, you know, 20 years ago, someone would have said, no, I don't think that's possible. So I would say, I don't know, Liam, I would say no, because I think I respect the art and the beauty of that, but the technology in flavors is always advancing. So perhaps it's a possibility.
Never say never.
Never say never. Never say never.
I mean, I like your answer, and I'm hopeful that you are right in your in your hope. As you say, it's not out of the realms of possibility, isn't it, given how fast things move?
Yeah, and to your point, I mean, it you can't say it hasn't been tried, because it's been tried again and again. You know, I suppose if there's a buck to be made, someone's going to try it, right? But I don't think it's ever been done successfully or very well.
Moving things on to maybe some of the more apparatus that you use to create these things, and you've already mentioned esters, and to clarify for the listeners, esters are a combination of alcohols and fatty acids, and typically have a fruity and floral aroma, and generated by yeast during fermentation. And I imagined your apparatus being very much focused on distillation and maybe lots of vacuum stills, but it sounds to me like you have a fair hand in fermentation as well.
Well, that's interesting. So Flavorman is not only a beverage developer and a flavor developer, we also have Moonshine University, which we have some stills as well. And so we do some of our own custom botanicals and extracts there. But when we start diving into the key materials, where we break it down to your esters, we'll focus on. Typically, we have suppliers for that. So I would love for my lab to have a lot of columns and a lot of apparatus that would be making the aroma chemicals, but most of that comes from external suppliers. Right. So in reality, a lot of the apparatus for flavor manufacture is mixers and stir bars. So, you know, a lot of the essential oils are coming from someone that can do it on a larger scale. So when we're doing custom distillations of essential oils and or extractions of actual botanicals, we're doing it on a smaller scale. And when customers go to a larger larger manufacturing, typically we might have to outsource that, because we don't have the capability of doing that large scale distillation here. And I think you'll find that with most flavor companies, you know, some of the bigger flavor houses will have in-house custom manufacturing of specific materials, not all, because it's cost prohibitive. But, you know, if you're looking for sulfur fractions, every specific flavor companies might have ways to make specific sulfur fractions or clean up ones that are on the market. But in general, it's pretty, the flavor lab is fairly rudimentary.
Incredible, given everything you're doing.
Yeah. It is, you know, there's, from a equipment point of view, it's more so GC and GC sniffers, gas chromatographs, and so on and so forth. But for actual extraction equipment, that's most flavor houses don't have that in their labs.
I see.
We'll be back with Liam and Tom in a moment, but first, we've got a feature we like to do called Desert Island Drinks, where we answer the drinks world's most famous small talk question. If you were stranded on a desert island and could have only one drink, what would it be? Here at Spirits Distilled, we've put a slight spin on the question and are inquiring of our guests, what is your one sipping spirit, your one mixing spirit, and your one guilty pleasure drink? In this edition of Desert Island Drinks, we pose the question to Hebe Richardson, drinks-based social media expert and owner of Drinks with Hebe, providing social media management for the drinks and hospitality industry. From bars to drinks brands, Hebe helps companies to develop their online presence. She also writes about fellow women in the drinks industry, showcasing their stories and how they find the drinks industry today. Here's what Hebe had to say.
If I was stranded on a desert island, sad times, right, three drinks I'd have to have. First up, Connemara 12-year-old, just neat. My husband brought this back from a trip of his when I was getting into peated whiskey, and it's Irish, so I just love it. Then to mix, I probably have some Tapatio Blanco with tonic, garnished with a slice of orange. Simple, delicious, more people should drink tequila and tonic. And then a little guilty pleasure is pina colada. I love that drink. It is so, so, so good. Like, couldn't drink it enough. Probably with something like Roncolon though, like with a snazzy rum, even better.
You know, it's the strangest thing. I also like pina coladas, but I don't like getting caught in the rain. I'm not sure what that means. Thanks, Hebe, for sharing your desert island drinks with us. Okay, put your crash helmets back on. We're about to jump back in with WSET's Liam Scandrett and Tom Gibson as they conclude their conversation about adding flavor.
So another term that will be familiar to many of our students is cold compounding, the blending of flavor with spirit. Could you tell us a little bit more about what this means and how it's done?
Yeah, you know, as far as that goes, it's pretty simple. When we're working on that, it would be, say, in the lab, if we're working on tweaking the flavor, we're dialing in the profile, and we may be simply adding that to GNS or whatever the base product is. And that in turn goes to our customer as a bulk flavor, and they're going to add it to that bulk spirit after fermentation. It's a simple blending step.
In terms of temperature, is there an importance of that? Is this done at room temperature or a much cooler temperature?
Sure. Well, it depends. Typically, we build the flavor for whatever process it's going through. And when we say build, that'll be accompanied by to take those essential oils, which are compounds that are hydrophobic, into finished solution. There typically needs to be a solvent. Most of the times that is ethyl alcohol. But if we're looking at higher heat processes, it could be other solvents to take it into the finished solution. Most of our processors, especially on the alcoholic beverage side, would be doing that as a cold process, just blending it in.
And those solvents are flavorless, or as close to as possible?
Flavorless, correct. Yeah, flavorless and specifically manufactured for specific properties. And you know, in a former life, I worked on flavors for confections. So often going into a high heat process, and even in beverage, you know, if you're going through a UHT process, you're going to have to be able to protect that flavor. Part of that is maybe concentrating the flavor more, but the other part of that is picking the appropriate solvent to quote unquote protect the flavor through the process.
Excellent. Thanks. So as I've said, we're quite fascinated by congeners and spirits and understanding their origins, whether it's compounds from a raw material, esters, fatty acids created by yeast, or vanillins and lignins from oak. So as a chemist, I'd like to hear more about kind of your chemical analysis, tasting and testing processes, and some of your favorite flavor active chemical compounds.
Oh, yeah. Wow, that's always tricky. That's a tough one to ask. You know, there are a lot of beautiful flavor compounds, but some of the best are some of the worst, I'd say, because we're dealing with these materials at 95% purity. So if I smell something like a methyl thiobutyrate, it smells like rotten trash, right? Uh-huh. And so you might look at those from a teaching perspective as an off note, right? But I look at it as in the right parts per million in a strawberry flavor, it makes the most beautiful strawberry flavor you've ever seen. But if you get it as a byproduct of fermentation and it's at 50 parts per million, it's going to make for a pretty bad distillate. So it's all it's all in the eyes of the beholder, and specifically the level too, right? So when we're tasting materials, we're evaluating them in finished product, but we also like to evaluate them neat. So in neat material, usually in distilled water, and we'll evaluate those at different parts per million. So in that case, I may taste it at 0.5 parts per million if it's methyl thiobutyrate, and that's sufficient. You can taste it, and it has some potential for different characteristics. So we can see that might work in berries, or it might work in mangoes, or it might work in other tropical fruits. But if you increase it to a certain point, it then takes on a different characteristic. And now it might not be suitable in a strawberry flavor, but it might be suitable in, say, a durian flavor, where you need those dirty, stinky right. off notes. And so there are materials that I love, from, you know, say neroli as orange flower. It's beautiful. We tend to look at them in a broader perspective on where they would go and what fantasy flavor that would make a really cool a flavor for, and to how it could support or maybe change the profile of a pineapple flavor or whatever that might be. So there's a lot of favorites that we have, but in specific applications, so to speak. I mean, come on, we talked about vanillin. It's fantastic. It's great in just about anything, right? Yeah. In general, is it my favorite? Nah, probably not. I like some of the more exotic sulfurs. I think those are pretty unique, and partly because when you taste, if we go back to durian, you taste a durian, and it might be a part per billion that some of those sulfur compounds are detected in, and you taste them like they just smashed you in the face. Yeah, so how cool is that? Quite unique. And to build those into a functional flavor takes a lot of art and skill to find the right level.
So, absolutely. Sulfur is a compound that's obviously difficult. Sorry, I missed that.
I don't know if I directly answered your question or spun that in a circle, but yeah.
Look, you're not the first guest to do that. It's politicking.
Well, that's my intention.
It was an interesting answer, nevertheless. I mean, to go back to sulfur, obviously that's a very significant compound in fermentation, and if not managed appropriately during distillation, can be very, very overwhelming, shall we say, in terms of kind of rotten eggs at its very, very worst, or at its best, you know, a slight burnt match kind of quality, which can be very, very positive in some Scotch whiskies.
Sure. Yeah, right. And, you know, and we're looking at that. So if you say rotten eggs, I think dimethyl sulfide, right? That's a very basic. And so for us, that's a key for any dairy flavor. We have to have a decent amount of dimethyl sulfide and a butter flavor. But also it finds really nice uses. And if you want to go back to a strawberry, a nice, creamy, rich, ripe strawberry, if I increase the dimethyl sulfide, it might go towards rotten or overripe. So when we're looking at it for flavors for distillates or liqueurs or whatever that might be, we have to look at that base alcohol and see what that looks like. So if it's high in dimethyl sulfide, we might not want to make a strawberry flavored liqueur that's high in dimethyl sulfide. So we really have to custom craft and build the flavor for our customers' finished distillate. So, you know, flavored vodkas were huge for quite some time and still are to some point. And you would think it's a colorless and flavorless material, so it wouldn't really affect. If strawberry works in one, it's going to work in another vodka distillate, correct? You would think, but it's not the case, because there's so many byproducts, or aroma chemicals, even in a vodka, or and that could be other things, the non-volatiles that affect how that flavor projects as a finished product. So that's what we say custom manufacturing of flavors is very important rather than a stock flavor coming off the shelf. It really hits the point to what the customer is working with.
Almost like a picture looking completely different in a different frame or a different setting.
Absolutely. Yeah. Add a little different lighting and the Mona Lisa might not be so beautiful.
Sure.
In the case, I doubt. But yeah, to that point. Yeah, you're right. It's, and you know, we're talking about that as a compound of a finished flavor. And now we're talking about it like breaking it down to the molecule and what that one molecule in the flavor could do to your finished product. It can make your customers think, oh yeah, that's truly a Mia's Nova strawberry, or that's most disgusting ever tasted. That's, you know, and that's to the eye of the beholder as well. So
sure.
Always.
I spent a week in Japan at the start of the year to visit distilleries in Kagoshima, Miyazaki, Kumamoto, Okinawa, and Amami, part of a WSET study tour. And we had a kind of deep dive into Honkaku Shochu and Awamori there. I don't know whether it's a spirit category you're very familiar with, but Kagoshima Shochu is made from sweet potato. And they have a whole array of different sweet potatoes consumed and grown in Japan. They're used for a lot of different consumables, sweets, more savory consumables, as well as this particular type of Honkaku Shochu called Satsuma Shochu. And the amount of terpenes you get specifically from some of these sweet potato varieties is actually incredible. So there's a lot of this kind of like rose flavor or lychee flavor. I think you mentioned a couple of terpene varieties before. Can you expand maybe on what flavors you were saying? There's just some citrus flavors and some floral flavors associated with those typically.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very interesting. And it's back to the point where you can, it's amazing where you can find different materials. You know, I wouldn't think of sweet potatoes as a great source for terpenes. So yeah, sure. It's a big topic at the moment because terpenes are a big part of the CBD market, right? So people are focusing on specific terpenes for health properties. And those terpenoids can come from a variety of different sources. So, you know, from our perspective, terpenes are just a basic building block of any essential oil. And they're quite high. Specific terpenes are quite high in citruses. So it's kind of interesting you say that too, because I wouldn't think of a sweet potato terpene profile being quite high. But if you look at citrus in general, they have, if you look at a lemon, lime, grapefruit, orange, they all have very similar terpene profiles. They all have the same terpenes, just at varying levels. And those varying levels give you the flavor profile that you're looking for, plus a couple key compounds, obviously. But terpenes are found in everything and really can be the backbone of any flavor profile. And then you said rose. So rose in general doesn't have a terribly high terpene profile, but some of the terpenes that are found there, say if we talk about limonene before, limonene is very high in orange. It's very low in a rose oil, but you'll find key materials like geraniol or geranyl acetate or so those alcohol acids, ketones, that then with the terpenes in the background are really what drive the full flavor profile. But I'm definitely looking up sweet potato terpene profiles after this.
Geraniol was definitely one that I noticed on the chemical analysis. And linoleum, is it?
Little.
Mm-hmm. That sounds right. Yes, forgive me, you're probably used to pronouncing all these, and you know they're just words on a piece of paper to me, so I have to make up the pronunciation.
Good. Yeah, little was quite high, and also one of those go-to flavor materials Linalool is often described as floral and woody. So very high in rose and its derivatives like linalool acetate and so on and so forth. But linalool for us is used in just about anything. We talked about mango, high in mango. Talked about strawberry, high in that. You would find it in an apple. It's kind of in varying levels in all different flavors you would find or profiles that you would be associated with. But when you get into more of the floral compounds, it goes way up and it gives really an interesting backbone profile. And it can be a driver of a lot of flowers and floral components.
The other very common compound that seems to be discussed on our courses, specifically when we're tasting certain rums, and certainly Jack Daniel's, is isoamyl acetate.
Yeah, sure.
Typically a kind of banana aroma, like a foam banana sweet. Is that how you typically encounter it as well?
And man, Liam, you hit it. We always talk about isoamyl acetate in some of the discussions we have with customers too. And I always ask them, what confection do they associate it with? And I'm always going for circus peanuts because I think that's the standard, you know? So foam confection products. But most often people go towards Laffy Taffy and I lose that. I lose that bet often. So yeah, isoamyl acetate is, it's kind of a love it or hate it kind of material. And this can kind of roll back to what we talk about. In the old days when we were making banana flavors, there weren't a lot of materials that could make that complex banana flavor. All we had was isoamyl acetate. So a circus peanut was basically just isoamyl acetate. So in very low levels, when you find that in rum, I think it's interesting because it gives such a nice fruity and almost an inherent sweetness, even just from the perception of isoamyl acetate, because it has such a confections a connotation or association. So we use it in just about everything at varying levels as well. But I like isoamyl acetate in rums, and I think that when we talk about mixed drinks and finished products such as that, it often ties into, okay, why is, a certain rum drink very popular? And there's typically a lot of fruits, and it ties together with those esters of ethyl caproate, isoamyl acetate. So yeah, wow, that goes really well with pineapple. And so they have those similarities, those compounds that kind of work synergistically together. So, I think that's a great lead into how flavors and liqueurs then work together to create this long running profile that's very popular around the world. You know, it's there's a reason for that.
Absolutely, that fruitiness is synonymous with many rums, certainly rums from Jamaica and places that really focus on that long, often wild fermentation and that long bacterial rest there, and yes, and the generation of some huge, huge fruity, floral, and often very, very bold ester contents and higher alcohols. The other one I wanted to ask you about was diacetyl.
Oh yeah, our favorite.
And I was interested to hear what your take on it was. We had an episode on fermentation earlier in this series, and both of my guests, Shane McNamara, who's now at AB InBev, and Maggie Campbell, who you might be familiar with at Privateer Rum, both started as brewers themselves, and diacetyl seems to be a brewer's problem, as they said it. I'm aware that it has a similar boiling point to ethanol, so can also kind of get intermingled with ethanol through distillation. Often a kind of buttery brown butter, but at its worst, according to Maggie, was a movie popcorn aroma, I think she gave it.
Sure, yeah.
Why is it your favorite?
Is it my favorite? Well, it is my favorite when I'm making a dairy flavor because it's, before we even go into that, I should say it's interesting that you bring it up for the flavor industry. It's kind of a sore subject as well, because diacetyl in the U.S. has been kind of maybe a little bit misunderstood, but there's definitely some merit to it as well, because it is synonymous with butter. Yeah, it is also naturally occurring in tomatoes. It's naturally occurring in just about anything you can think of. But in this movie Popcorn that we speak of, diacetyl is used in the flavor industry in pretty high levels. And so often when it was going into into microwave popcorn, the processing caused what was now called popcorn lung. And so diacetyl has effectively been banned from the flavor industry for safety reasons and not in whole. So it's a son of a gun to make a really great butter flavor without diacetyl, but we've found ways to do it through other materials. But it's really important in fermentation. And so I don't know if your question is it something that, I mean, it's often found as a fault, right, Liam? You know, if you have a corked wine, you're going to have a chunk of diacetyl. But that diacetyl is always there through fermentation. It's just under that threshold that people perceive as being good or bad. I love it for dairy flavors, but I don't think I like it particularly for my alcohol flavors that I'm developing.
Sure. You said it's banned in terms of use for flavors now.
Yeah, so there in the U.S. the regulations, there's a Prop 65, so California banned and diacetyl in manufacturing plants. So it is effectively, it just has found its way out of favor and to be used in any food, a flavor for any food now. So it's very often that it's very rare that it's used in flavors any longer. Now that's not, it's not found in natural products. So there's natural products that contain a decent amount of diacetyl. So if it's naturally occurring, you might see some diacetyl showing up, but I mean, it's safe for consumption. It's not safe for inhalation, and it's not safe for inhalation at very, very high levels. At normal levels, it's just something that you see in every brewery. So it's an interesting compound for the flavor industry.
And what are the substitute compounds for that butter flavor now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, if I told you, I'd have to kill you, Liam.
Well, I don't want that. So maybe we put that question to one side.
No, there's other materials that have a perception of butteriness. So those materials might be similar to the structure of diacetyl. They might be substitutes such as, you know, lactones that have that creaminess. They don't have that same butteriness, but there's ways to use those different combinations of materials to elude that sense of a true natural butter. Now, you said brown butter. If you're looking for a brown butter, you might want to add a little bit of a pyrazine to your diacetyl, and that'll give that nuttiness that you're looking for. Diacetyl on its own is pretty, it's a strong buttery compound without anything that comes along with it, almost a little bit chemical in nature.
Right.
Yeah.
You mentioned lactones. That's one we sometimes come across in terms of American whiskey as well. It's present in oak, is it? And gives a coconut kind of flavor typically?
Yeah, so lactones are a series of compounds that are very important in alcoholic beverages, whiskey in particular. I think that would also go towards rum as well. But they're a lowlier, so to speak, and profile. They don't really jump out at you. It's more of a material that gives creaminess, silkiness, sometimes mouthfeel. So the so-called whiskey lactone that we're speaking of from oak is, you know, on a smelling strip, when we're smelling it, it's not something that really jumps out at you. You have to look for it, but it's so important in the finished profile. Without that, you miss some of those building blocks or pieces that put together the puzzle that is a nice whiskey flavor.
Right.
But for a flavor, we might look at that whiskey lactone and say, wow, that's pretty interesting. Maybe we could use that in maybe a mouthfeel enhancer, just because it doesn't have a lot of profile, but it does have some sort of a body. Or maybe you would say, I think I could use that in a strawberry too. You might look at that. We look at it from using it where it is in nature, and then how it applies to supporting and making an interesting flavor in other respects.
It's interesting to hear you talk about texture and mouthfeel as well, because, you know, we think of you as, you know, creating flavor that's sensed by, you know, our sense of smell and our sense of taste. But something we're always harping on about in terms of tasting spirits is the importance of texture and feel. And that's an important consideration for you, I guess.
It sure is. And usually you don't attribute aroma chemicals to the texture or mouthfeel of a finished product. I mean, you're thinking of your residual sugar, or you're thinking of, you know, if it's something like a finished product, there might be glycerin. You know, those are the things that you think of for mouthfeel, not flavor materials. But really, you know, 50 ppm of whiskey lactone or any lactone can give real body, yeah. Something that you can sense and sticks around, gives longevity to the flavor profile.
That's really cool. Really, really insightful. Tom, this has been mind-blowing and very, very, very interesting for me personally, but I'm sure that the listeners and our students are going to get a huge amount out of it as well. Thanks so much for your time.
It's a pleasure to talk to you as well, and I think you had a lot of great insightful questions, among one being some insights on sweet potato that I'm going to have to dig into.
Look, I've got lots of contacts in Japan now from that week. I don't know whether you've ever visited Japan, but the Japanese like a business card, so I've got a collection of about 250 business cards from a week-long trip. So yeah, I could put you in touch with some distillers in those prefectures if you need. I would highly recommend a visit. It's an incredible place, and we're very, very lucky to go and get the insight that we did.
Excellent. It's definitely on my list. And I hope I answered all your questions and didn't create more for you.
I find that is always the case. You get one question answered and it just opens out a whole load more, doesn't it? But that's why we're in this industry, because there's just so much to know and so much to learn.
That was truly great. Thanks, Tom, for sharing your knowledge and wisdom with Spirits Distilled. Before we end our episode, we have another feature that we like to do. It's called Letter to My Younger Self, where we ask some of the spirits world's most experienced and successful players to let us know what advice they would give themselves when they were first getting started on their journey. In this edition, we've got Joe Cavassa, brand ambassador for the Macallan at Edrington. Joe is a distilled spirits expert and master bartender with extensive education on spirits and experience developing and implementing brand education and training programs, having conducted over 23 years, well over 5,000 sessions in 45 countries across 5 continents. What a resume. I can't wait to hear Joe's advice to his younger self, which he shares with us today in both Spanish and English.
I'd like to do this first in Spanish, and then I'll do a brief translation in English at the end, if you don't mind. Carta a mi yo más joven. En la vida he aprendido que la suerte es una ecuación matemática, que es preparación multiplicado por oportunidad. Es decir, mientras más te preparas, más puedes aprovechar las oportunidades. Y esto es importante porque no solamente hay que prepararse para poder lograr hacer una buena ejecución, sino que la preparación te ayuda a identificar las oportunidades. Si no sabes cuáles son tus habilidades y qué puedes hacer, definitivamente no vas a identificar cuando las oportunidades se den, porque no estás preparado para ellas. Y eso siempre ha sido importante y lo has hecho muy bien. Sin embargo, después de 28 años en esta industria, que es dinámica, cambiante constantemente, que se abren oportunidades todo el tiempo y de manera abundante, no solamente es importante prepararse, sino también aprovechar la oportunidad en el momento indicado. Hay un refrán muy famoso que dice que cosas buenas le llegan a aquellos que tienen paciencia y esperan. Pero la versión que yo creo que aplica a este momento y este consejo que te doy a ti, mi yo más joven, es la versión de Abraham Lincoln, que dice que hay cosas buenas que llegan a los que esperan, pero solamente las que sobran de aquellos que se arriesgaron. Así que prepárate, sí, pero toma el riesgo. Haz un balance entre la preparación para hacer una gran impresión y aprovechar la oportunidad en el momento mejor indicado. Ahora, para la versión en inglés, the English version of the letter to my younger self. In life, it's great to be prepared because the equation, the mathematical equation for success, in my book, is preparation times opportunity. Meaning the better you prepare, the more the opportunities will multiply. And that is true, and you've taken advantage of that quite nicely. Nonetheless, it is important also to take the opportunities at the right time as well. You see, preparation is good because it doesn't just allow you to do a better performance. It also allows you to identify the opportunities when they come by you. But if you can keep preparing yourself just to give the biggest impression possible, the window of that opportunity either diminishes or closes altogether. So there's a phrase that's quite used quite often that it says, good things come to those who wait. And it's nice and that is good advice. But the one I like the most and the one most ideal for this message that I'm sending to you, my younger self, is the version of Abraham Lincoln that says, good things come to those who wait, but only those left over by the ones who hustle. Take the chance. Not just prepare yourself to give a great impression and a great performance, but take the chance when you have it, when it's right there, so that you can take the biggest advantage of that opportunity in your preparation. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe, for sharing your advice with our Spanish and English speaking listeners. That was really inspiring. And that brings our episode to a close today. Thank you, Liam. And special thanks to all of our guests, Tom Gibson, Hebe Richardson, and Joe Cabasa. Thanks for all that you do to add flavor out there in the drinks world. I hope you enjoyed the program. We hope you'll join us again next time for another fantastic episode. Until then, I'm Dave Rudman saying cheers from WSET. Thanks for listening to the Spirits Distilled podcast presented by WSET, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. Please remember that the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WSET. If you enjoyed this program, please take a moment to subscribe and rate Spirits Distilled on whatever podcast platform you are coming to us from. For more information on taking a WSET qualification, please visit our Where to Study page on our website, wsetglobal.com.